The Guardian.
Support for this podcast comes from Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes creating a professional website for your business, personal brand, or portfolio so easy, it's newsworthy. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer Guardian to get 10% off.
Hello and welcome back to another Tech Weekly from The Guardian. Coming up...
The reality is that we can fall in love online, and sometimes that intensity is stronger than in our physical relationships.
Romancing the Machine, with a spate of films about falling in love through machines, or indeed with machines, we speak to the UK's foremost expert on cyber sex and relationships mediated by technology. Professor Monica Whitty will be discussing why our love of technology is mutating into technological love. Also, we'll be looking at some of this week's tech news, including Edward Snowden's plea to hackers to protect users' rights, a flurry of changes around key services from Facebook's buy button to Twitter's attempt to take on WhatsApp, and the Irish government pulls the plug on the Open Genealogy database over security and privacy fears. Is it the first, or are they overreacting? This is Tech Weekly from The Guardian. In the studio this week, we have The Guardian's finest. Head of Technology, Jemima Kish.
Hello.
And also tech reporter is Samuel Gibbs.
Hello.
And Alex Hearn.
Hello.
Welcome, welcome. First off, let's do the serious stuff. We turn to the comments made in the last few days by NSA whistleblower Edward Snowden about the need for tech-savvy people to use their skills to innovate to protect our digital rights and privacy. Now, before we turn to Alex, who wrote about this, let's hear an extract of a Guardian exclusive interview with Edward Snowden himself. He was interviewed by The Guardian's editor-in-chief, along with defense and intelligence correspondent Ewan McCaskill. We strongly recommend watching the full video interview, but here, Snowden discusses the need for improved privacy across the board.
Is technology compatible with privacy?
Absolutely. Technology can actually increase privacy, but not if we sleepwalk into new applications of it without... considering the implications of these new technologies. The question is, why are our private details that are transmitted online, why are our private details that are stored on our personal devices any different than the details and private records of our lives that are stored in our private journals? There shouldn't be this distinction between digital information and printed information. But the government in the United States, the government in the United Kingdom, and many other countries around the world, is increasingly seeking to make that distinction because they recognize that it vastly increases their powers of investigation.
People use the analogy of the haystack and the needle, that you need to collect all this information in order to look for the needle of specific intelligence that you're looking for.
I would argue that simply using the term haystack is misleading. This is a haystack of human lives. It's all the private records of the most intimate activities throughout our lives that are aggregated and compiled and stored for increasing frequencies of time. It may be that by seizing all of the records of our private activities, by watching everywhere we go, by watching everything we do, by monitoring every person we meet, by analyzing every word we say, by waiting and passing judgment over every association we make and every person we love, that we could uncover a terrorist plot or we could discover more criminals. But is that the kind of society we want to live in? That is the definition of a security state.
When did you last read 1984?
Actually, quite some time ago. Contrary to popular belief, you know, I don't think we are exactly in the 1984 universe. The technologies that are in 1984 now seem unimaginative and quaint. You know, nowadays we actually buy cell phones that are the equivalent of a networked microphone that we carry around in our pockets with us voluntarily as we go from place to place and move about our lives. 1984 is an important book, but we should not bound ourselves to the limits of the author's imagination. You know, our times have shown that the world is much more unpredictable and dangerous than that.
Do you think this is the end of cloud computing?
I don't. I think what cloud companies need to pursue in order to be truly successful is what's called a zero-knowledge system, which means the service providers host and process content on behalf of customers, but they don't actually know what it is. That's the only way they can prove to the customers that they can be trusted with their information.
What's a good example of that?
There's a company called SpiderOak. SpiderOak is a competitor to Dropbox, but Dropbox is a targeted, you know, wannabe Prism partner. They just put, I believe, Condoleezza Rice on their board of directors, who is probably the most anti-privacy official you can imagine. So they're very hostile to privacy. SpiderOak, in response, has structured their system in such a way you can store all of your information on them, but they literally have no access to the content of that information. So while, yeah, they could be compelled to turn it over, you know, the law enforcement agencies still have to go to a judge and get a warrant to actually get your encryption key from you.
Do you use Google?
No.
No?
I don't use Google.
Do you use Skype?
No. I have used Skype and Google Hangouts, which are great, but unfortunately security-compromised services, for public talks where they've been required, but I wouldn't use it for personal communications. We shouldn't trust them without verifying what their activities are, how they're using our data, and deciding for ourselves whether it's appropriate where they draw the lines.
Alex, clearly Edward Snowden believes that we cannot trust most of the mainstream services that we use. You covered his recent address to the HOPE conference in New York City. What did he say there?
Well, his main plea was to the assembled hackers, programmers, developers there to turn their attention towards this. I mean, it's probably something that he almost didn't need to say. I doubt there were many attendees who weren't already exercised by it. But there are still, you know, there are other issues which excite the interest of the hacker community, which maybe by process of elimination, Snowden was saying, stop focusing on that so much. Maybe digital rights management isn't right now the biggest thing that matters. Maybe we should just put all our attention on encouraging developers to protect privacy of users.
Jemima, is this actually the case? Do we need to stop focusing on digital rights management and making ourselves into cyborgs and focus on privacy and security?
Well, it's difficult to pick out DRM specifically as something we shouldn't be doing,
obviously.
But I would argue that, yes, sorting out this knotty sort of tension between the correct balance of state security and the right to individuals to have a kind of free expression and the right to privacy online is absolutely critical. Part of that is a technical challenge and part of it is a sort of ethical intellectual one.
He also mentioned, well, perhaps not specifically, but when he was talking about state interventions, he raised the issues of the DRIP bill, which was rushed through Parliament and and the House of Lords last week. What did he say about that? Or rather, what do his comments that he's been making recently raise in light of what happened over the last couple of weeks?
Well, the argument for rushing through the DRIP bill was that it needed to be pushed through in response to European legislation on data protection, except that that doesn't quite hold water because that went through in April, so there's been a conflict there since April. So why rush it through with only 20 members in the House? And actually, in the terms which described different laws about holding user data, they'd also actually extended and expanded the powers of the state to monitor and to hold user data. So they're kind of pretending that they were putting it through under the data retention guise, and it was actually a much broader piece than that. Some critics have pointed out that we're now in a much weaker place when it comes to pointing out the flaws of oppressive regimes who do much more invasive and pervasive surveillance of their citizens. And we're on very thin ice, I think.
Alex, I want to turn back to you and talk a little bit more specifically about Snowden. What are we to do about his level of mistrust? I'm not a hacker. And so what can I do?
Well, actually, much of his talk was essentially, in polite terms, offering criticism to the hackers there that there isn't a huge amount we can do. He singled out for sort of backhanded praise a set of email encryption tools called GPG, which are currently one of the best ways to encrypt your email. Once your message is encrypted, it is unbreakable. But as far as we know, even the NSA cannot read the contents of it. It's also nearly impossible for a layperson to set up on their own. It doesn't actually make clear what is and isn't protected when it comes to metadata around the email. And what's called the trust model, the understanding you have of sort of the theory of how security actually works that lies behind it, is utterly impenetrable.
Jemima, I've noticed actually in your SIG you have a PGP key, which then goes to a PGP code. Now, and this is different from what Alex is talking about.
PGP,
which is,
GPG is an implementation of PGP. So they're the same technology, but one is a specific version of it.
Okay.
The problem is that translating these tools, I mean, even technologists sort of quibble over what is the best standard and which is the best tool. So translating all of these tools to a much broader audience, and this is one of the points that Snowden made, that lawyers, doctors, journalists, anyone professional who needs to protect, really protect their clients' information or their sources' information should be using these tools. But if technologists are struggling to implement them, then how are they going to reach the mainstream? And it seems like there's no kind of on or off. There's kind of 50 shades of kind of comprehension you have to go through. So you have people that really understand this, or you kind of understand it a little bit, but if you start using a service which claims to be secure,
you know,
who built it, has it got a back door, do they do code audits so that they're effectively peer reviewed, or is it from an organisation that's been rated by, say, the EFF, the Electronic Frontier Foundation? It's incredibly complex, and also we don't know how long it is before these services are compromised. So we've tried to consider whether we need to do a kind of EFF style chart, kind of endorsing these technologies, but we could endorse it 1 week and they could discover a backdoor in it the next. It's almost impossible to do.
Sam, I just want to pose more of a theoretical question. Rebecca McKinnon wrote in her book, Consent of the Networked, that we understand how power works offline, but we don't understand how it works online. What do we need to know about online to really understand how power works there?
Well, information is power, and grabbing information is what everybody wants to do, and it's very easy to do online because everything you do leaves a paper trail. I mean, we're kind of used to it in the UK from the perspective of every footstep you make outside is almost captured by CCTV cameras. With the assumption that that kind of thing happens online, we're much more able to deal with the kind of prospect of the surveillance and the power proposition online compared to offline. People think that because you're sitting in front of a computer that you're not actually like exposed, because that's your computer, you are isolated, but your computer is you, as a your data is on the computer and represented in a digital form.
I think there's a fundamental anthropological point here, which is that if you don't see and feel a real human being in front of you, it's like they don't really exist. So you know when you're posting to a social network, for example, that potentially thousands of people are reading your thing. But because you don't see and feel those people, and this was beautifully illustrated in a play that was in London recently called Privacy, all about the effects of surveillance and how it actually affects us personally. And they picked out a random member of the audience and brought up her tweets for everyone to read. And she was really embarrassed. And all of those tweets are public, but it was just because she was in a room with real people that the embarrassment was maximised.
Alex, what will make this whole situation better? Go on. $64,000 question.
Ooh. Better, it doesn't have to be hugely better. A slight improvement still makes it better. One thing Snowden did do was bring out some tangible improvements that can be made, moving away from ineffable questions like the balance of privacy and security towards simpler things like, the example he brought up is that if I'm speaking to you on Skype and I say something, although the communication is encrypted, there's still a clear burst of packets that are sent. And that is information. You can see how long I was speaking to you. You can see roughly where the silences were. It's encrypted, but the way it saves bandwidth means that there is still information there. So one example Snowden brought up is we need to improve this. We need to make it so that the form of the encrypted information does not itself give away more information. Along the same lines, a short email is obviously shorter than a long email, encrypted or not. These are all small, tangible improvements that we can make to encryption that will just make us all slightly more secure. If your stuff is encrypted, it's good to know that it's actually fully safe.
For the best and most insightful coverage of all Edward Snowden and privacy-related news, just go to theguardian.com. Again, we highly recommend that you watch the Guardian exclusive interview with Edward Snowden in full. You can find that on our site. You can also subscribe to The Guardian's YouTube channel. That's youtube.com/theguardian. Access to state records, census information, and other government data sets has become a key part of discovering our family histories. And digital genealogy services abound. But all that data, not a problem, right? Your mother's maiden name? Your birthday? All part of the public record, right? Well, there is a problem, according to the Irish government, who closed down parts of their genealogy portal recently due to concerns about data privacy. Alex, you wrote about this as well. What is the government's concern?
Well, it's the Irish Data Protection Commission. Their concern is essentially fairly clear. It's that being able to go into an office and pay some money and get a paper copy of a birth certificate is fairly different from being able to type in anyone's name and get a copy of their birth certificate. One is inherently limited by the form. You aren't going to be able to industrially harvest data. Also, I mean, it's limited by things like, if you walk in and ask for 4,000 copies of 4,000 different people's birth certificates, they're going to look at you a bit oddly. An online form doesn't have any of that turned on by default. You can install security, but if you haven't, then it's actually more than just making it freer and easier. It is a qualitatively different offering. And the problem here is that the Irish government essentially had this great idea of freeing the data. They had this information which was clunky and locked behind the need to pay money and actually contact an office and get a paper copy, and they opened it up, which is great and admirable. But they don't seem to have realised that in the act of opening it up, they changed the nature of the data they were giving out. And so the Data Protection Commission stepped in and said, essentially, whoa, hold up there. You said you were going to be making things like census information from 100 years ago available. You didn't say you were going to be doing this. Turn it off. And they did.
Jemima, are we seeing the end of the golden era of information sharing? The sunset clause, as it were?
Well, hopefully we're seeing the end of the golden era of people not really considering the full implication of putting personal information online. And I'm not talking about the individuals, because these were civil records. But, you know, the people who are setting up this project need to know the implication of putting all of that data up and do it in a secure way. It's a very logical and quite imaginative and rather nice project, but in the wrong hands, as we know, that data is, well, pretty dangerous.
Samuel, we're not going to therefore see any other sort of copycat shutting down of government databases, are we? So, for example, not including issues of personal data, but perhaps, you know, bus timetables or anything like that. Are we gonna start to see things clamping down, closing down?
I'm pretty sure bus timetables are fine. I hope so, because I use them every day. basically, it's just whether it's the correct selection of personal data, whether this stuff should be available online. It's really thinking about what the data can be used for. Like, most public services are perfectly fine. Most of them are not personally identifiable. Anything that is just generally available, like bus timetables, fine. But personal details that could be used to get into your bank account, that is not something you want online.
Alex?
At the same time, one point that it does feel like is worth being drawn out of this is that we seem to be hitting the limits of the ability to treat essentially factual information as a secret or a security hazard. The problem for this, the thing that everyone jumped on, is that, yeah, if you can find my birth certificate, you can find my date of birth and my mother's maiden name, both of which are commonly security questions on things like online banking. Obviously, one solution there is stop giving out my bleeding birth certificate. But another thing to ask is, are we actually reaching the stage where questions like who is this person's mother, when was this person born, are too easy to answer? If right now it's relatively hard for you to Google when I was born, it's only going to get easier. There's no turning that faucet off. And, you know, it's a problem for security. It's a problem that is easily answered if you say, banks, stop asking me mother, maiden, name, let me set a password and just ask me that. But then people forget passwords, and hey, there are a lot of problems with passwords as well. But it does seem like information, factual information, like where do you live, what's your mother's maiden name, isn't secure enough anymore for things like banks.
And indeed, we discussed that on the podcast a few weeks ago, how best to create a secure and safe password. You can read up on this issue at theguardian.com/technology. Over the last several days, three key online services rolled out updates and innovations. That's pretty standard. But these innovations suggest a trend towards three established companies getting a little bit spooked by their younger upstart rivals. Twitter updated their app to grow chat and take on WhatsApp. Facebook announced a buy button, and Amazon gave us a glimpse of their book subscription service. Oh, woe to libraries. Let's kick off with Twitter. What is Twitter's WhatsApp play, and how serious a concern, Alex, is it for WhatsApp?
Essentially, Twitter has had direct messages for years. Everyone sort of knows about them. Everyone who is on Twitter uses them a bit. But for Twitter itself, Twitter the company, they've always been a bit of an awkward little historical relic. Twitter is about public, searchable, scannable, tweetable, shareable, hashtagable, advertisable information. Direct messages don't really match that. And for a while, it really did seem like the company was dialing them back. They put no real investment into them. They broke them. I mean, direct messages were broken on web Twitter and on Twitter clients for quite some time. I mean, the obvious thing is it looks like the $18 billion sale of WhatsApp to Facebook made them reassess that and go, oh, actually, giving someone the ability to have offline textual communication over the net between their friends with an identity that we own and control, that is also quite useful. And so, as Sam reported the other day, Twitter is going to start tightening up its direct message service, making it work.
Sam, is Twitter losing ground?
So Twitter's afraid that it's going to get to saturation point with its current model. And one of the ways to go past that is through chat apps, effectively. And you've only got to look at WhatsApp's meteoric rise. It now boasts 500 million users to see that this is where people are going. I mean, and it's engaging at a much younger age, which is definitely what all these social networks want to do.
Jemima. I love the way that Twitter, with its 255 million users, is now considered an underachiever. What a crazy world. Twitter has always had an approach which is relatively cautious when it comes to commercializing its business or kind of being very public about its strategy. They've been much more sort of gentle and much more cautious in how they've sort of implemented their service. This is the first time I can remember where it really seems like they've been pushed into going in a certain direction, which they haven't before. And I'm wondering if it's shareholders sort of looking at the Facebook WhatsApp deal and pushing them in that direction. But generally, what the place to watch with Twitter is second screen, because they still very much think that media and advertising is going to be where they're going to make their money, even if it's a smaller audience than Facebook, say. So I don't think direct messaging is completely key, although maybe direct massaging is, I don't know.
I'm sure there's an app for that. Jemima, let's talk about Facebook, their buy button. What is the story here?
Well, it was only a matter of time before this happened. So they're implementing a buy button alongside things in the newsfeed, so you don't even have to leave Facebook to spend money. So it's kind of one step, buying stuff, I suppose, is one step closer. You don't even have to see the advert and, you know, and have brand reinforcement before you go off and spend something. You can just spend right there on Facebook. They've never made any pretense about not being a commercial environment. We'll have to wait and see how sort of invasive it feels. And we'll also have to see how accurate their targeting is, because some of the stuff that's been advertised to me in Facebook is not appropriate. So they might want to tweak those levers and engines of their recommendations first.
Yeah. I'm at the moment, I'm playing around with Facebook's algorithm just to see how far off it can possibly be. So Google already thinks that I'm a 24-year-old boy. So let's see what we can do with Facebook. Sam, do you think that people will use this? I mean, it's you know, all about reducing the clicks, isn't it?
It certainly is. And maybe if the targeted advertising is good, people will hit that buy button. I mean, I don't know. The ads are on Facebook have to appeal to the user. Does the user instantly go, yes, I definitely want that. I'm not going to look anywhere else. It's the internet. You know, nobody shops around. I don't personally, I see an advert, I might buy it. I'm probably not going to click on that advert. I'm going to have at least have a look at some secondary source, get a second opinion before I buy the thing. I don't know. People have been able to buy things on Facebook for a while. Some stores have been able to open up basically within Facebook brand pages and have their own kind of storefront. I don't know whether people trust those more than they would a separate website.
If they can really, in a very sophisticated way, combine the buy button with recommendations of your friends, which they haven't really managed to do in a very convincing way so far, it could be quite powerful. But really silly things like we went to Glastonbury and got various sort of monkey and gorilla and ape outfits. I have no idea. We just thought it would be funny. And one of them in particular was a gorilla holding a man in a cage. And it was a very good outfit. And I think a lot of people actually probably would have clicked to buy that. But that might be a niche example.
That was a pretty remarkable outfit. I would definitely click to buy that. I thank you very much to Jemima for bringing that remarkable thing to my attention. Alex, is anybody else doing this kind of thing? I mean, this kind of has hints of Google AdWords and sponsored ads.
The race for payments is certainly hotting up. It's been hotting up for the better part of a decade now. Google has its checkout. Amazon is also quietly becoming a third-party payment processor. Certainly Kickstarter actually relies on Amazon's ability to take money and then guarantee that you'll be able to take money in the future. I think the dark horse in this, as ever, is Apple, who, because they're so locked into their own ecosystem and not visible on the open web, get a bit forgotten. But being able to buy things through in-app purchases and having to buy things through in-app purchases if they are on the iOS platform provides it with a huge amount of income, although apparently around the same income that it costs it to run the App Store and to run its digital services. It doesn't seem to be a net profit producer. But it's going to cause a problem for Facebook, certainly, because Apple demands that everyone spending money on their platform spend it through the in-app purchases, which it seems to me would preclude Facebook from offering this on their iOS apps, or if they did, would preclude them from making any money at all because they would have to hand over their share to Apple.
It also raises some interesting things. I don't know if it's related, but with their application for licensing, bank licensing. So perhaps we are answering from our perspective, our point of view, but obviously they've got eyeballs and earbuds, I don't know, earlobes in various parts of the world where remittances and other types of purchases are particularly interesting. We'll talk about that at another time. But Alex, you mentioned Amazon. They announced a subscription service for their Kindle users. What is it? And should libraries be weeping?
For one lovely monthly fee, just $9.99, you can access 600,000 Amazon books on your Kindle.
He's available without an agent, people.
It's a great deal if you want to read a lot of those 600,000 titles. The problem is Amazon hasn't managed to sign up any of the big five publishers for this deal. So most books that you've heard of and want to read aren't available on it. That most books is less most books than last time Amazon tried to offer this with its Prime Select Lending Service, I think it was called.
Prime Lending Library.
Previously, Amazon was offering a different selection, a smaller selection, and a subjective judgment, an even worse selection of books for free to people who had Amazon Prime. That service is not quite being wound up, but it's being quietly forgotten about in favor of this new one price, all you can eat, more books, better books, but not the big five publishers books offer.
Samuel, who is freaked out by this?
So authors are kind of freaked out by this. I don't know whether they should be or not. It depends what the kind of kickbacks they get from each read. I think with the lending library, somebody has to make it through 30% of a book. Something around that before somebody gets paid, so you can read 30% of a book and not get paid. But the big five publishers, as Alex said, Amazon is in a war with them at the moment, and the big five were also attached with the Apple ebook price fixing whole thing. They settled. Apple's still fighting. Technically, it's offered a settlement, but may not have to pay because it's still going through the courts, and there might be an appeal anyway. So in that kind of case, the authors, I'm not sure, are particularly fond of it. The big five are not particularly fond of it. And nobody seems to really, in the book world, particularly like Amazon, even though they kind of rely on them to shift loads of books?
I don't think anyone in the entire world likes Amazon of any kind of world.
Well, I don't know. Independent publishers who are publishing through the Amazon store. I mean, could this not be for them?
It's a big boost, and the lending library and this both rely heavily on those Amazon-published books.
So, Jemima, you mentioned that Twitter, with its gasquillions of people being pushed out by young upstarts or being beyond its prime, was a bit of a joke. But actually, is this a general trend, the way that these very well-established services are kind of playing around the edges with what it is that they can and should be doing? Does this show their age, their establishment credentials?
Well, maybe it's a midlife crisis. You know, they started off as doing one thing, in Twitter's case, something very different, and then they had to morph into something else. And now they're seeing they're under pressure to sort of shore up their business and to prove that it can make money and to reinforce their proposition. And perhaps it seems just too much of a risk to put all their eggs in one kind of service basket. So they're trying to do what other services do as well. In Amazon's case, that is being, you know, e-commerce in absolutely every field. For Twitter, I don't know. It's a much more niche service, but I'm still quite addicted.
A huge thanks to the team, Jemima, Alex and Samuel. To keep up to speed with breaking tech news, just go to theguardian.com/technology.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace. When you need to know what's in the news, you turn to The Guardian. When you want to create something newsworthy, you turn to Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it easy to create your own professional website for your small business, online store, professional portfolio, or blog. Getting started takes only seconds. Just go to squarespace.com, and to support this podcast, use the offer code Guardian to take 10% off.
Today, finding or nurturing relationships online is almost a default in most advanced global economies. As the Oxford Internet Institute's 2011 report, Me, My Spouse, and the Internet declared, it's now part of the modern marriage market. The next step, forming relationships, but not via the machines, with the machines, is of late a growing theme in cinema, specifically between Joaquin Phoenix's character and the AI Samantha in Spike Jonze's provocative Her, and Terry Gilliam's latest film, The Zero Theorem. One of the advisors on Gilliam's film, and an expert in digitally mediated relationships, is psychologist Professor Monica Whitty, author of Cyberspace Romance, The Psychology of Online Relationships. And I'm glad to say that Monica joins me down the line to discuss her work. Welcome to Tech Weekly, Monica.
Hi, thank you for having me.
As always, it's delightful to speak with you. As you know, I've been stalking your work for many years. So hopefully we'll get to talk about some of the really interesting areas that you've been covering in terms of the psychology. But before that,
tell me
a little bit about the kind of, well, first of all, I suppose, give me a bit of background on the Zero Theorem and where that concept fits in. And then if you wouldn't mind, it would be great to hear your thoughts on Spike Jonze's Her.
Well, I guess in regards to the film talks about a man that questions his identity, and it looks at the idea of having cyber sex and having a relationship in cyberspace. And these ideas are not new to us, but in a fantasy film, I guess you get to question again, how real is this? And you know, early days of the internet, it was seen as a bizarre idea that you might actually fall in love with someone online. And I remember over 10 years ago now, people saying, oh, how odd someone's left the country to fall in love with someone in another country that they've met on the internet and never met face to face. And of course, this is not so unusual anymore. But the questions are still asked, can you still feel that intensity of a relationship and the intensity of sex or cyber sex in the same way that you would in a face-to-face relationship? And the same thing is happening now, except we have more visual cues, we can have more senses at our avail to have cyber sex. But the reality is that we can fall in love online, and sometimes that intensity is stronger than in our physical relationships.
quite. And it's fascinating, isn't it, given that you've been studying this for such a long time, that there are still stumbling blocks to people recognizing that this kind of intimacy, whether it's a non-physical but a kind of physical intimacy, or even that emotional intimacy, is something that's possible via a computer. Why do you think people are still resistant to that idea?
I guess they're resistant to it because we still like the old-fashioned idea that everything should be in the physical world. I guess the other issue is it might seem contrived in some ways, and some ways it can be, because you experiment with who you are and you can experiment with love and sex. And some of those things aren't possible in the physical world. Of course, when we look at issues about internet infidelity, which is not the issue of that particular film, but you can see how come this has become a new problem in our time, because in some ways relationships online and sex online can be more ideal and more perfect than in the physical world. So given that, that can be a threat to people's real physical relationships, because they yearn for something that you just really can't have.
You mentioned online infidelity, and I know you've done quite a lot of work on that. So much of what you've described through your research is about the emotional connection. And there is an element of online infidelity, and apologies for the spoiler, but in Spike Jonze's film Her, although infidelity is a kind of, it's a contrivance, I suppose, that at least propels the plot forward a little bit, whether it is infidelity or not is to be questioned. Now, what? Tell me a little bit about what you found from that film, because it was a slightly different conception. It was more of a science fiction persuasion, rather than falling in love online and having sex online with another person. It was about falling in love with and having sex with an artificial intelligence.
Yep. And you're exactly right in saying that emotional intensity. That's so important for people to understand, that when you're communicating with someone morning, noon and night, and you're disclosing information about yourself and precious information that you leave for someone that's really important in your life, then it's hard to actually think that this is not real. So it's a real emotion people actually feel with another person. And in some ways, this can be great for individuals. They have this wonderful experience that in some ways is more perfect than anything else you could have. But on the other level, it could be a real problem for people. This is not a real person, and you want to transfer that into the physical world. Then what do you do about this? Well, you can't. So you have to accept that this is an intense emotional experience, but something that can only remain in cyberspace.
And this idealization is something that is also raised when you're talking about people falling in love with other people online. And specifically, what I wanted to move on to now is something that you have studied, again, extensively. Monica, you study a lot of things extensively. I have to say, it's remarkable. But the online romance scam. Tell me a little bit about the online romance scam, because this is something that's not fantasy. It's actually reality.
Yeah, it is reality in the sense that it's a real experience for people, but it's similar to this AI kind of experience. So the online dating romance scam is when a criminal sets up a relationship with a potential victim, and they might meet on a dating site or on a social networking site, and they will start emailing them, they'll start instant messaging them, it'll move to text, they'll even move to phone calls, because you can disguise your voice through phone now. And so they tell them everything they want to hear about how wonderful they are, and they get to experience being more loved than you can ever be. And they're constantly in their lives and showing complete interest in them. So it's so hard for people to detach from that once they've gone through the grooming process of really believing this is real and really wanting this. In fact, it's so hard that when people are told this is not a real relationship, you've been conned, and people are conned out of awful lots of money, mortgaging houses and the like, they nonetheless still crave that relationship, even if they accept this wasn't real, it was actually a criminal trying to take money from them. And some of the men, for instance, will still say, well, I understand it was a male now who was communicating with me, however, I still want that relationship, and some will still even go back to that relationship. So, and some of the women will say, well, how is it that this person really didn't feel anything for me? They must have felt something, otherwise they wouldn't have listened to me, they wouldn't have communicated to me. So it's very hard to say these people are actually more psychopaths who can separate that emotion and feel absolutely nothing for that individual. And lots of people have heard about the scam now, but it hasn't actually stopped the numbers. So this really is testament to the fact that people can feel really intense in relationships online, and they need to be careful to know how real this is. What do I really want out of this relationship?
When we last spoke about the scam, this must have been, I'm assuming it was sort of 2010, 2011, when we spoke for the column for The Observer, Untangling the Web. Mm. And you were very closely involved with promoting, sort of advocating about this issue. Mm. How has the online romance scam evolved in that time?
Well, it has evolved. It still continues in its current form, but it has changed its form too. There is another type of scam where men are blackmailed because they'll have cyber sex with a criminal online, not realizing they're a criminal. And that is recorded, video recorded, and then the criminal will go back to them saying, I will tell your wife, I will tell your workplace, this has happened, I will send them the video unless you give me money. And they tend to give money very, very quickly to stop the blackmail happening. So this, they target infidelity, online dating sites, the criminals for that one, and social networking sites and so forth. And the harsh reality is that they do send the videos if they're not given the money. So, 'cause they don't care, you know. So this is a new version of it that people need to be very, very careful of. I guess the other thing to people to be aware of is that there are various other types of, well, there's many types of mass marketing fraud scams, but within those scams, people set up a relationship with the victim. And it's not always a romantic one. It can be a friendship. And because of that, then they trust that person. And that person doesn't realize it's not a real friendship. It's not a real relationship. So they're more inclined to help that person out, thinking that this is something genuine and real.
There's also some really phenomenal work on the criminal side, involving, you know, crooked lawyers and and you know, providing papers that are perfectly legitimate and absolutely valid, and getting things checked out. You know, you would think that the people that you're talking about who are scammed are, you know, emotionally a little bit, well, not emotionally loose, that's not the best way of putting it, but certainly, you know, they're being duped because they're being duped, right? But in fact, in many cases, people are doing their due diligence, aren't they? So, you know, this is an incredible industry.
That's absolutely right. And I think that's a really important point, because people will look for things. They will, you know, they'll check, okay, have they really bought the plane ticket? And then they'll send them the boarding pass. So they think, well, it must be real. They will, send them documentation saying that, yes, this is set up as a genuine business. People do their homework on it, but there are cues that demonstrate this is not real, but they'll often skip those cues. But it's not that they're not doing the work. So then they think, well, I've done my work to check it up. I've got some evidence, so therefore it must be okay. But when you interview victims and at that particular point, when you're going, actually, have you not seen this? Then they will argue, but I've seen this other bit of information, and they really lock on to that information. So that's a bit, because they want to believe it's real as well. But it is important for people to understand it can hit anyone. There's scams that target every single person out there. And just to be careful of the information they're receiving.
What are some of the cues that people can keep an eye out for?
Yeah, well, I guess if you're not meeting that person face-to-face, that's a big cue. So that my first suggestion is, for romance scam at least, if you're talking to someone from an online dating site and they're not going to see you within the next month and they give you various excuses why, and they may seem very legitimate, cut that relationship off and move to others. Because the problem is, once you've been groomed, it's really, really hard to leave that relationship. People of all sorts, lawyers, teachers, you know, many different professions are brought into this who are very clever people, but once they're there, they really find it hard to leave that. So at least with the online dating romance scam, that's my advice. We used to say don't give any money, but it's hard to say that to people, because once they're there, they'll still do it. They'll give the money. So it's trying to avoid them actually being groomed in the first place.
So given the real dangers of online romance, falling in love with somebody via the internet, and indeed falling in love with an artificial intelligence, are the plots of Zero Theorem and AI far too outlandish? Are we going to correct our behavior online when it comes to falling in love so that these eventualities just simply don't happen because they're far too potentially dangerous?
Yeah, it's really hard because it's a natural inclination for people to trust another person, and you don't want people skeptical out there. We're trying to do extra work to actually point out to people what are the cues and also the language that is used, and also develop software to be able to go, okay, this particular conversation is indicative of a scam. So beware of this, so that it's automated for people. So this is the kind of work we're moving towards in the future to help people, because it's really hard to make those judgment calls. And when you want it to be real, it's even harder to make that judgment call.
To check out Monica's work, you can follow her on Twitter. And Monica, that's Cyber Psy, P-S-Y, as in psychology, but P-S-Y. And Terry Gilliam's Zero Theorem, starring Christopher Waltz, is out on DVD now. That's all we have for you on this edition. Remember, there is breaking tech news and analysis day and night on theguardian.com/technology. Not to be used sparingly. Thank you for listening. I'm Alex Krotowski, and Tech Weekly is produced by Jason Phipps. We'll be back next week. Tell your friends and join us. Bye.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.